Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 3, the 21st of April. We ended our previous episode with General Buss's 9th Army starting to gradually withdraw from the Order front line, as this would prevent themselves from being annihilated by two attacking Soviet fronts. As Buss's forces are now retreating towards the Spreewald area, and the soon-to-be pivotal town of Halber, we are entering the real meat and potatoes part of our story. Thus, the following episodes in the series will look at the encirclement of the 9th Army, the battles they faced, their breakout attempts, and their escape to the West on a day-by-day basis, allowing us to cover the unfolding drama from all angles in detail. So let's get going. The aforementioned withdrawal, which started on the 20th of April, continued into the 21st, and elements of the 9th Army were now taking up positions in the Spreewald area, while some units did remain on the Order front line engaged in battle with the 1st Belarusian Front. The fact that the 9th Army was divided in this manner, with some units retreating whilst other units were holding firm, was seen as a tactical consequence of the overwhelming strength of the Soviet forces. And Busse certainly wasn't ordering his forces into a large-scale retreat at this time. As we covered in the previous episode, Busse had to walk a fine line between following the orders of the Führer to try and hold positions wherever possible, whilst at the same time trying to save as many men and civilians as possible from certain captivity or death at the hands of the Red Army. Busse's reluctance to defy the orders of Hitler wasn't just born from a lingering sense of duty and honour to his commander-in-chief, however. He was also mindful that if he didn't follow orders, then he might be charged with treason and then be strung up by an SS-sponsored kangaroo court. Busse's fears were justified here, because on April the 21st, an order was issued to Army Group Vistula explicitly prohibiting any movement westwards, and that any officer who failed to follow this order was to be immediately arrested and shot. In any case, General Heimichi continued pleading with German High Command to sanction a full-scale retreat of the 9th Army from the order, as he feared it could be split into several parts by nightfall if it didn't pull back. High Command, on the other hand, kept insisting that Schöner's Army Group Center forces from the south could link up with Busse's forces in the center and establish a strong defensive line along the order. Therefore, the 9th Army was ordered to stay put. At 5:20 in the evening, Hitler further ordered the 9th Army to hold on to their existing positions from Cottbus to Fürstenberg, and from there, curve a defensive line back via Mühlrose to Fürstenwalde. At the same time, the 9th Army was ordered to establish a strong front between Königs Wusterhausen and Cottbus, from which repeated, vigorous, and coordinated attacks were to be made upon the two Soviet fronts. As grandiose as this order sounded, it was impossible for the 9th Army to carry out, as they were facing multiple threats and setbacks. Firstly, the 9th Army's northern flank was coming under direct attack from Zhukov's 3rd and 69th Armies, as Zhukov was seeking to protect his southern flank, which was now entering Berlin. This Soviet thrust on the 9th Army's northern flank near Fürstenwalde was particularly worrying, because it threatened the rear of the 11th SS Panzer Corps, who were still trying to hold their positions east of the Spree. Secondly, the supply lines of the 9th Army were being squeezed, as Zhukov's forces captured Erkner, just southeast of Berlin. This thrust effectively cut off the 9th Army from the capital. Thirdly, Konev ordered his air forces to start harassing the 9th Army, meaning that even when the Germans weren't facing head-on assaults, they were always under constant bombardment of some kind. Lastly, the tidal wave of refugees who were fleeing the Soviet advances in towns such as Frankfurt-Oder, Cottbus and Fürstenwalde was starting to have a real impact on the operational effectiveness of the 9th Army. The fact that there were still so many civilians close to the front line was down to a failure in Nazi Party policy, as the party wanted to avoid defeatism in allowing evacuations to happen. This ensured that civilians continued to remain in the combat area close to the front line until they were forced to chaotically evacuate at the last minute once the Soviet onslaught broke through. Compounding this problem was the added headache of the thousands of extra refugees camping in the forests of Brandenburg following their exodus from the Soviet advance in Prussia and Poland over the previous months. Busse complained about the presence of civilians and how this impeded the movement of his Ninth Army, but little could be done at this stage, and this problem would only get worse in the days to come. All of these factors combined led Heimichi to advise Busse to now start disregarding the orders coming from high command and to continue shifting his forces away from the order front line. Busse therefore relocated part of the Ninth Army away from the Frankfurt Oder area and towards the town of Rauen instead. Here, new command posts for the Ninth Army were established along the banks of the Scharmützelsee. As the battle entered the Spreewald area, preparations were being urgently made to secure the town soon to be on the front line. The town of Märkische Buchholz, for example, was declared a fortress, given the fact that it was a central transport hub containing a series of bridges over the River Dahme. One of these bridges, which was on the main road leading to Halbe, will play a vital role in the evacuation of the 9th Army forces in days to come. Parts of the 21st Panzer Division were deployed into the Halbe area to set up a defensive line there against Konev's rapidly advancing tank forces from the south, whilst a Waffen-SS unit occupied Halbe itself in order to prepare the town for battle against the Soviets. The Halbe Volkssturm urgently built more defences for the town. This included anti-tank barriers, which were constructed along the main street of Lindenstrasse and along Kirchstrasse leading southwards towards Teurow. The Volkssturm also dug trenches and foxholes in the woods surrounding the town. Everyone else in Halbe simply moved into the cellars, took their valuables with them, and hoped for the best. Willy Hennecke's family moved out of their home in the centre of town and moved into the cellar of a family friend's house near the riverbank. Here, he explains why. The reason was simple. We figured it was too dangerous to remain in the Lindenstrasse, seeing as it was the main road, cutting through from east to west. A retreating army would be forced to take it, and the enemy would not hesitate to blast the army, albeit already defeated, and use their air force too. They would have no compunction about strafing and bombing. In addition, we had to consider the likelihood of street fighting, and we certainly had an inkling of what that entailed from having watched newsreels earlier in the war. It would have been sheer madness to remain at home, and, as it turned out, what we feared might happen did happen. But never could we have imagined the extent of the severe mauling and the gruesome scenes we were to witness. The horrors that unfolded in Halbe were far beyond what this town had ever experienced in its history. Whilst the Ninth Army was wondering how to deal with the collapse of the Oder front line, Konev solidified his rapid advance to their rear. Recognizing the incredible opportunity he had to encircle the Ninth Army and block off any retreat westwards, Konev started deploying his newly arrived 28th Army into the area between Bayreuth and Zossen. Over the next few days, this force was to establish an impenetrable screen of defensive lines and anti-tank barriers in order to thwart any possible westward move from the Ninth Army. And in addition, the 28th Army was to protect the Soviet tanks rapidly moving up along the major road towards Sossen and South Berlin. By now, Konev's 3rd Guards Tank Army was fanning out in a broad thrust across Brandenburg, with some tanks even reaching Königswusterhausen, which compounded the isolation of the 9th Army from Berlin. The 3rd Guards Tank Army also captured Kummersdorf Gut, where the Wehrmacht had its artillery testing grounds. In order to stop the advance, locals had been frantically dragged into the lines of defence. They were told to dig holes, and they were given simple rifles to stop the tanks. Soviet tanks appeared on the horizon of the Kummersdorf Gut early on the morning of the 21st, and the Germans blew up the impressive ammunition stores there in order to prevent their capture by the Soviets. Inevitably, the locals were no match for the tanks, however, and 3 teenagers, a young woman, and 4 older men were killed in the fighting. Konya's 4th Guards Tank Army was also busy on the 21st, as they continued their advance onto the Jüterbog and Potsdam areas, capturing the towns of Troy and Beetzen and the village of Niebel in the process. Apparently, the inhabitants of Troy and Beetzen were expecting the Americans to arrive, and they were surprised when Red Army units rolled into the town. American flags which had been hung up in advance on people's windows were quickly exchanged for red flags once the identity of the attackers was known. The most important event to happen on the 21st of April, however, was the Soviet capture of the German army headquarters at Zossen. Zossen was the central command hub for the Wehrmacht, and since the beginning of the war, Hitler's armies had been coordinated from a complex of buildings and underground bunkers here. The building Maybach 1 housed the High Command of the Army, the OKH, and the building Maybach 2 housed the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces, the OKW. Whilst Konev and Stalin had noted the significance of Zossen and recognised the incredible attraction its capture presented, the Germans didn't seem to realise the danger Zossen was in at all, and only a small detachment of troops had been ordered to defend the critically important complex. Zossen was plagued with anxiety, as they knew the 3rd Guards Tank Army wasn't far away. Already on the previous day, General Krebs, who was Chief of Staff of the OKH, had ordered Zossen's small detachment of troops to go southwards and investigate reports of Soviet tanks around Beirut. At 6 a.m. on the 21st, German High Command's worst fears were realised when the detachment commander, Senior Lieutenant Krankel, reported that 40 tanks were advancing northwards along the B-96 major road in the direction of Zossen. The Zossen detachment was ordered to engage them, but armed as they were with only light vehicles and infantry, they had no hope in stopping the advancing T-34s. Krebs immediately telephoned the Reichschancellery and asked for permission to evacuate the staff from the complex. Hitler refused this request. Putting a brave face on things, the daily situation conference took place at 11 a.m. as usual, but the air was thick with tension as the firing of tank guns could already be heard in the distance. One officer present remarked that the Soviet tanks could be there in as little as 30 minutes. Lieutenant Krankel sent another message saying that his attack had failed, and that there was nothing standing between the Soviet tanks and Zossen. So at 1 p.m, Zossen was finally ordered to evacuate. The OKH was to relocate its headquarters to a Luftwaffe base at Eicher near Potsdam, whilst the OKW was to evacuate to the tank base at Kramnitz. The order to evacuate had been given just in time, as shortly after their departure, Soviet soldiers entered the complex. The resident caretaker led them on a guided tour of the buildings and bunkers, showing them a vast array of maps, documents, generators, phones and printers, and the Soviets couldn't believe their eyes. As the troops were being given the tour, one of the phones rang, and a Soviet soldier nonchalantly picked it up. On the other end was a senior German officer asking for an update on the situation, to which the Soviet soldier simply replied, in Russian, "Ivan is here," before telling him to go to hell. I like this anecdote from Zossen, because whilst there is an impending human disaster about to unfold in the Halbe area, the shoddy defence and frantic last-minute evacuation of the German High Command at Zossen really shows how farcical the state of German leadership had become during these final days of the war. No one could be in any doubt now. The once mighty German Reich was collapsing. The loss of Zossen exacerbated the dire communication issues plaguing the Wehrmacht, and it became even more difficult to maintain a clear command structure which could react to the changing situation on the ground. However, chaos breeds opportunity, and Busse would soon be given an opportunity to save his forces and their accompanying refugees from certain destruction, thanks to the entry into our story of the German 12th Army, led by General Walter Wenck.